Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the heartland, in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Tavern. Terrible Tommy's Tavern was closed yesterday. Yeah, Tommy was out running around. I'll tell you more about it later, but right now we got Frank Bawa, the man who has been studying for a long time about how to keep you alive and how to maybe have to keep other people not so alive. Here he goes. Oh, I forgot one thing. The date is September the 2nd, 2008, Tuesday.
Oh, this is another edition of Insurgency 101. I hope these have been useful. I hope they give you somewhat of an idea of what may come to pass if things keep going down the perilous path that they're going. I'm going to pick it up here, dealing with protracted war, popular forces versus regular armies, the guerrilla as missionary. That means you got a message to spread. And Mao Zedong and the War of the Fleet, the lessons of China. I also want to maybe go into another book for some cool examples. Okay, here we go. The seeds of revolution are slow to germinate. The roots and tendrils spread out silently underground long before there's any sign of sprout or bud. They suddenly, one day, like new wheat, spring up in a cultivated field. There's a blaze of color and overnight growth, and rebels are there and everywhere. It is customary to speak of guerrilla wars as wars of attrition. This phase is not perfectly accurate. Guerrilla war is not so much abrasive as subversive. Subversive. It is a growth that penetrates the crevices of a rotting structure and one day bursts it asunder. You know, if this system does go down in our lifetime or in the lifetime of our children, I'd like to have it where it is Aryans who are putting the axe to the roots of this rotted tree and not La Raza or some other militant black group. I hope it's us. I really do. Okay. Yet attrition does not, after all, play a great part. In the political sphere, the government is subjected to a constant wearing pressure that comes from the great expense and anxiety of the anti-guerrilla campaign, and from the constant cry of opposition, the banks, the community, the business community. When will it end? What are you doing about it? They'll ask the government, the system, George Bush, John McCain, whoever. Economic attrition has already been discussed. Sabotage is one aspect of it. Speaking of sabotage, I had an interesting conversation the other day, and he heard my August 25th show, the monologue I did, and he disagreed with me about the sabotaging of utilities. He told me that it's a very viable thing, especially you know, if you consider America or any other Western country, England, France, Germany, death to the German state, the current German state, I hope nothing but bad things happen over there from what I've been hearing. But in the War of the Flea in the West, sabotage of utilities is very viable. I think we need to think of the white race. 90% of the white race is our enemies. You know, they can see what's going on. They watch the same news I watch. I can't believe that 90% of the white race is so stupid as not to see what's going on. They see what's going on, but they're too cowardly to take a stand. And this kind of goes right into what I was thinking about the other day. I don't remember exactly how it was worded, but it was in the Turner Diaries. And one of the things that William Pierce wrote in there regarding his main character, Earl Turner, like I said, I can't quote it verbatim, but he said something to the effect of that, you know, the struggle, the movement, needed to create an atmosphere in the country, in America, or anywhere else, Canada, Australia, that's more feared than the system. Because if you leave it up to the people themselves, they will not do anything. An analogy I like to use is this. Picture the entire white race in North America as symbolized by a formation of men standing at attention, a formation of white men standing at attention in like a military formation. And on each back of this 100 of these 100 soldiers is a black 80-pound pack and a brown 80-pound pack, 160 pounds. And any of you who've been in the military know that you cannot fight effectively with 80-pound or 100-pound ruck on your back, a rucksack. If you come under fire, first thing you got to do is hit the ground and kick your rucksack off to the side where you can move more easily. But picture the white race as this 100-man formation. And each year, these 100-pound or these 80-pound brown and black packs, these picture them wearing brown and black military packs, and they're getting bigger and bigger. And 5 years from now, they're 120 pounds each. You know, and if you look at this formation from afar, all you'll see is black and brown. And what is holding up this system of black and brown? It's the hard work, it's the ingenuity, it's the technological aspect of white geniusness. What we need to do is bring the system down, subvert it. Because if we don't, we're like a lifespan. We're like this energy source for black and brown to feed off of. And as long as we keep, you know, doing things to make society easier and better, as long as we keep nipping diseases in the bud, you know, so they don't claim too many victims, so to speak, we're helping black and brown multiply, triple, double, quadruple over, you know, 10 years, 20 years. Let's go back to the Stone Age. Let black and brown fend for themselves. Let there be a massive die-off, not only in North America, but Europe also. And the white man will take care of himself. And, you know, and let's see who the best race is. Let's go back to zero. Let's bring everything back to zero. That means no more Super Bowl, no more World Series, no more Stanley Cup, no more watching Friends and Cheers on TV on a nice comfortable couch in a nice comfortable living room. And if none of you want that or none of you want to subscribe to that, you know, then don't be part of the struggle no more. You know, I'm sure Glenn Beck will take you on as one of his listeners, or maybe Rush Limbaugh. But we can't talk no more. We can't bullshit around with mindless politics and techniques. Sorry for the curse word there. I've been told to curve my cursing. Economic attrition has already been discussed. Sabotage is one of the aspects of it. The loss of credit and investment suffered by a country engaged in a civil war is the other, far more important aspect, period. No small nation and a few great ones can stand the deprivation indefinitely. Yet the painful fact is that the guerrillas, for their part, can carry on indefinitely. See, a military army needs all kinds of resources and logistics, you know, to keep it going. A guerrilla, an Aryan partisan, a member of the Aryan partisan army, you know, he's got a pack on his back, he can live off the land. Like a Hank Williams song, a country boy can't survive. He can skin a deer, you know, he can shoot a buck, and he can do all these other things, but the muds in the cities, they depend on these handouts from the white government, the white system. You take away this system, they stop breeding. Having no vested interests, no political opposition within their own ranks, no economic problems other than those that can be solved by extending the war and capturing what they need, the insurgents have nothing to lose and everything to gain by continuing to struggle. And on the other hand, they have nothing to gain and everything to lose by giving it up. Think about that. We have nothing to gain and everything to lose if we don't act. Very interesting phrase there, Robert Tabor. No truer words have been said. In fact, once the banner of rebellion has been raised and blood has been shed, it is no easy matter to give up. The rebels begin to fight for whatever reason. They continue because they must. Okay? The result. If the guerrillas are to be successful and avoid extermination, it is a protracted war. The result is a protracted war. They don't give it up. I'm going to keep fighting the system. It'll eventually be a protracted war because your ranks will swell with the disaffected and the marginalized. The conflict must continue until the movement has recruited and trained enough men and come into possession of enough arms to build a revolutionary army capable of defeating the regular army in open battle. Well, if we're going to do that, you know, and this is a different time from, you know, Vietnam and the communist guerrillas in China of the 40s. The technology they got now is just amazing. I'm reading this book that Tom Metzger gave me to look over, and it deals with security. And the things they got today, just in the realm of surveillance, will blow your mind. Like, they got this thing, I think it's called LEDS. LEDS is a acronym for something, but it's this. They have this device where they can shoot a laser at the window of an apartment, a condo, a high-rise, a house. And this laser picks up the vibrations in a room where conversation is taking place. And that laser converts these vibrations into an electronic message, so to speak, and it's deciphered on the other end, where they take these vibrations transported by the light, by the laser, back to its source, and they decode, or basically they can re-scramble something. I don't remember the exact terminology. And they can pick up your conversation. I mean, you know, they could shoot this laser from miles away at your window and, you know, and it reinterprets what a conversation is taking place. You know, and this book that I'm reading so far, or after this pamphlet, 100-page pamphlet, talks a lot about security, computer security, cell phone, telephones. If you have a room in your house that you're going to talk to someone, it's got to be, you got to have something to generate some kind of noise, either outside the room or inside the room. There can be absolutely no telephones in that room. And it's got to be a room that has absolutely no compromise, absolutely no windows. If you don't have that, then you have no business saying what you got to say to somebody because it can be picked up. They got microphones now that are smaller than the head of a pin. They got cameras that are, you know, smaller than a cigarette. So let's not delude ourselves we do have the moral high ground in this thing, but let's not delude ourselves into how evil this system is. And that's the problem with a lot of people. They just don't see the evilness of it. They go through life with rose-colored glasses, and I'm sorry, people that do that and don't see that, you know, if power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. They just don't see that. And I was listening to this message on resist.com the other day. It was the July 31st message. And, you know, I guess Tom Metzger has some new intro to it where it's like somebody's scanning the frequencies for a radio station to listen to. And one of the voices that comes on is something about this is a message or something, and some people just won't get it. We can't worry about that, even if they're family members. You know, I've basically turned my family members over to the dogs. You know, the only way that they're going to really come to my way of thinking is if they suffered the extreme shock of brutal violence. You know, I mean, that's what it's going to take for a lot of people. But I remember something that Tom Metzger said on the July 31st show. He said, yep, it's Thursday, July 31st, 2008. You'll never see this one again. Think about that. Think about you guys listening, you guys and gals, listen to this show right now, whether you listen to it because you're part of a radio club or you listen to it a year from now on the internet. You'll never get this one back. You'll never have this day back. How many opportunities have we squandered? Because we still want to keep playing politics of the word and not politics of the deed. Continuing on. Failing this, it must continue until political developments resulting from the campaign have brought about the desired end. The rising of the masses of the people and the overthrow or abdication of the discredited government. In such countries, it will be sufficient, barring intervention by the dominating colonial power, to create, by guerrilla warfare, the conditions in which a discredited government, discredited because it can no longer keep law and order and assure a profit to the country's proprietors, falls from lack of support and the revolutionaries rush in to fill the political vacuum. Have to concur there. Cyprus provides a good example of an insurgency that was successful simply because terror, sabotage, and constant disorder made the island too unprofitable and politically embarrassing for the British to remain. You know, you want to hit these guys. I saw an update the other day, an Aryan update. There was a picture of some guy speaking before, I guess, a large crowd or whatever, and he turned out to be some high-ranking CEO of some company. I don't remember what. I don't have a computer in front of me. In fact, I don't own a computer. But, you know, and I think Tom Metzger put a caption underneath it, know the true enemy. And you want to affect these guys, you need to hit them where it hurts. You're not going to find out where these guys live. They own so many properties. You know, you don't have an itinerary to their activities. You don't know where they're going to be. But, you know, I've said it before, and I'll say it again until I'm blue in the face. We don't have economic power, military power, police power. We don't have media power. We don't have business power. We don't have cultural power. We have absolutely no power in this country or in the West at all, except disruptive power. We have the power to disrupt, like a wasp. A wasp in a car traveling down a highway going 65 miles an hour stings the driver on the neck, then flies in the next passenger and assaults him, and et cetera, and then comes back to the driver and causes havoc with him, and, you know, he steers or does something and throws the car out of control, and it rolls over and over again, killing all the occupants. And maybe the wasp gets out the broken window and flies away. Or maybe he dies with it, but he dies with honor. You know? Think about that. Continuing on. How can a nation that is not industrialized defeat one that is? This says former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State E.L. Katzenbach, Jr., is the problem that confronted Mao Zedong. The answer, which applies to insurgency everywhere as against the mechanized army, is guerrilla warfare. As Katzenbach sees it, Mao's approach to the theory of war, as applied to his own particular situation, that of China, was simply to shift the emphasis customarily given to the fundamental components of previous military doctrine. Will the industrial nation stressed such tangible military factors as arms, logistics, and manpower, says Katzenbach, Mao looked to the intangibles, time, space, and will. Lacking the arms with which to confront well-equipped armies in the field, Mao avoided battle by surrendering territory. In so doing, Katzenbach writes, he traded space for time and used the time to produce will, the psychological capacity of the Chinese people to resist defeat. This is the essence of guerrilla warfare. Now, it can't exactly play out this way with us because we're a different people from the Asian. The Asian has an insect mentality. You Asians listening out there, I don't mean that as an insult. Not that I care what you think. But the Asian race has an insect mentality, meaning it's just within their biological and genetic heritage to conform. How many times have you seen some news story in Thailand and the Philippines and Indonesia, Malaysia, and, you know, the reporters on the streets talking about something? Look in the background. Look how the people are dressed. It's like every single male is wearing a white button-up shirt. Every one of them. You know, I mean, in Japan, you know, I guess they got, you know, rebels now because they've been westernized. You know, they got Western culture over there. They got Japanese band, they got Japanese heavy metal bands now and so forth. It's because of the exposure of the West. In fact, I know for a fact that I read somewhere that Mao Zedong, before he went on his military campaign, read the writings of Rousseau, Robespierre, Voltaire, and a couple other French revolutionary writers of the time. And I read somewhere he quoted, it's like, I never knew people thought like this. You know, and eventually he returned back to the writings of his own racial roots, like Sun Tzu and other people. But, you know, when these Western philosophers were translated into the Asian languages, they were just blown away that men could think like this. There's nobody in the world like us. You'll never hear a nigger admit that. Hold on, I need to catch the last sentence of the previous page so I don't read it out of context. I'll just read a short paragraph here. Although Mao never stated it quite this way, writes Katzenbach, that sounds Jewish. The basic premise of his theory is that political mobilization may be substituted for industrial mobilization with a successful military outcome. This is to say, his fundamental belief is that only those who will admit defeat can be defeated. So if the totality of a population can be made to resist surrender, this resistance can be turned into a war of attrition, which will eventually and inevitably be victorious. The context brings to mind a well-known quotation from Mao, "With the common people of the whole country mobilized, we shall create a vast sea of humanity and drown the enemy in it." Well, we'll never have those numbers, so don't even think about that. I think with us, I really do, I think with us, we're going to have to, I don't know, I'm probably going to piss some people off by saying this, but think about this. We are losing North America. It is not hyperbole. It is a fact. We are losing this country. You know, like Tom Metzger said on a show a while back, a show he did with me, we're not losing anything. We lost. And driving around this Labor Day weekend in the Chicago area, not in Chicago, but the surrounding suburbs, I was in the north suburbs the other day, and I cannot tell you how many Asians and Hindus are in the northwest suburbs, which were historically white for so long. You know, we're not going to win the popular support of the people, so we might as well, we small few, we band of brothers, so to speak, we might as well see the white sheep out there. We might as well not even care about them, really. I know that sounds messed up, but we might as well not care about them. We might as well see them as maybe like the enemy. How dare they live such comfortable lives, coming and going, partying, you know, throwing parties, giving parties, going to parties, drinking beer, wine, and spirits of, you know, uncalculable names. I mean, you know, how long are we going to go on like this? I mean, you know, if we keep going on any longer, then it's absolutely going to be too late for us to do anything. You know, the non-white races in North America now, I mean, they have not only large numbers, but they have, you know, the ability to drown us with their numbers by the, you know, how prolific they are. And even these Hindus and Pakis that come over here and become doctors, they don't have one or two kids. A lot of them have like five or six kids. Just like Jose and Maria, who came across the Rio Grande last night illegally. You know, think about that. Walk down the street where I live, I hear Mexican music everywhere. Large portions of this part of the United States, signs are in Spanish. Got church marquees in Korean, Chinese. How much longer? Where are you at, 100th monkey? Maybe I'm the 100th monkey. Continue on. Mao holds that military salvation stems from the political conversion. But note, conversion takes time. So Mao's military problem was how to organize space so that it could be made to yield time. His political problem was how to organize time so that it could be made to yield will, popular will. With equality, or not quality, hell no, not equality. With quality, which makes willingness to sacrifice the order of the day, and the ability to bear suffering cheerfully the highest virtue. So Mao's real military problem was not that of getting the war over with, the question to which Western military thinkers have dictated the greater part of their attention, but that of keeping it going. You know, any kind of resistance movement in this country that becomes a movement of activism and not words has got to be kept going as long as possible to drain resources, to burn up money, to burn up fuel, burn up gasoline, make it even more scarce. Are you guys afraid of that? Maybe you guys are driving around in SUVs and you don't want to give them up, but, you know, you call yourself an insurgent. Hey, when I point a finger, I got three pointing right back at me, buddy. I'm not some guy who talks shit and doesn't back it up. I'm not one of these computer commandos. I say this over the phone. I'll say it looking in anyone's eye. I have no problems with what I say on the phone or in person. So once our struggle gets to a point of deeds, we need to keep it going. No matter who gets imprisoned, that's the only way to win, because if a system gets a short victory or a victory after 5 years of struggle, they've won. We need to burn up resources. Mao's problem then, how to avoid a military decision. His answer, hit and run. Fight and live to fight another day. Give way before the determined advance of the enemy. And like the sea, close in again as the enemy passes. The formula, space for time, is well conceived. But in his selected military writings, Mao makes it clear that nothing is gained unless the time is used to produce political results by raising the revolutionary consciousness, the will of the masses. You know, I'm going to keep talking about this. There's a flyer. I know NA's got one. You guys get a hold of one. At the top of the flyer, you can put Nubian Guerrilla Front or African Republican Army. Use whatever is in your imagination. And you take the mugshots of those niggers in Knoxville who did what they did, and you put their pictures larger, and maybe you put a caption around it, Hall of Fame Brothers or something like that. You put little pictures of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom underneath it, and the flyers would say something like, this is what we did to this white cracker devil bitch, and this is what we did to this cracker devil punk, you know, because they like to use the word punk a lot. And have it under there that this is what's coming to all you whites and, you know, all you white MFers. And I have to slow down what I'm going to say because I know I want to say, I will say a curse word, but, you know, it offends too many people. I'm a foul-mouthed working-class white guy. I'm a foul-mouthed because swearing to me is a catharsis. It feels good when I curse. But if it offends people, I guess I got to watch it. Continuing on, our chief method is to learn warfare through warfare. A person who has no opportunity to go to school can learn warfare. He can learn through fighting in war. I don't know about that. In fact, I wrote in the book, no. I don't agree with that. You're not going to rush into this thing unprepared. You need to know military tactics. You need to know unarmed hand-to-hand combat, knife combatives. You need to learn how to fight with a bludgeon. You know, I mean, a handgun, after it's ran out of ammunition, can be used as a viable weapon. You guys need to go to school, man, and I hope it's being done. I'm a glass half-empty kind of guy. I'm doing these monologues. This isn't about me. I don't think anything special about myself. I'm doing this because I don't trust enough of us out there are reading the right stuff. You want to read Mein Kampf for the seventh time? Believe me, there's plenty of stuff out there about National Socialism. If you want to read anything, read Hitler and I from Otto von Strasser, or read William Joyce, Twilight Over England. You know, you need to start reading the right stuff, reading stuff that deals with the subject I'm reading about here. I don't do this for some grandiose thing to get my name out there something to have an ego about. This isn't about me. This is about you doing a proper reading, and I'm doing this because I don't trust people are reading. I'm a glass half-empty kind of guy, and that's just the way I'll be till the day I die. A Revolutionary War is a mass undertaking. It is often not a matter of first learning and then doing, but doing then learning. I don't know about that. For doing itself is learning. There is a great gap between the ordinary civilian and the soldier. You're damn right there is, and you better close that gap with knowledge. But it is no great wall, and it can be quickly closed, and the way to close it is to take part in revolution in war. I don't know. I disagree with that a little bit. That's something Mao said. This isn't something Robert Tabor said. He's quoting Mao by saying that. And maybe that was successful in an Asian nation, but that won't be with us. All right. Political mobilization. Raising the level of political consciousness of the people and involving them actively in the revolutionary struggle is the first task of the guerrillas. And it is the nature of this effort, which necessarily takes time, that accounts for the protracted character of Revolutionary War. The study of Mao, however, discloses something more. Time is required not alone for political mobilization, but to allow the inherent weakness of the enemy to develop under the stress of war. Very interesting. Under the stress of war. Against the Japanese, war-making capacity were pitted the Chinese advantages of space, time, and will. The long struggle for national liberation, as Mao notes, has tempered the Chinese people. Social and political gains have created a will that was capable of great sacrifice and resistance over long periods of time. Similar considerations determine the protracted character of the struggle against the warlords, and later the, whatever this word is, it's Kamau Ming Tang or whatever. I don't speak Zipperhead, so I don't know what that is. During China's long civil war, in analyzing the Chinese situation, Mao notes the contradictions and conflicts of interest that arise on several planes. For example, between the various imperialist parties and powers, seeking dominance in China. Within China's Chinese ruling class and between the ruling classes on the one hand and the broad masses on the other and the people of the other. One, conflict among warlords and against nationalist government creates a heavy burden of taxation. Well, that's good. You know, like I said before, use up resources. Heavier taxation causes the landlord class to exact more exorbitant rents from the peasants and increase the hatred of the latter for the landlords. Three, the backward condition of Chinese industry as related to foreign industry and foreign concessions in China causes a more vicious exploitation of Chinese labor and drives the wedge deeper between the workers and the Chinese bourgeoisie. Four, because the pressure of foreign goods, the exhaustion of the purchasing power of the workers and the peasant masses, and the increase in government taxation, more and more dealers in Chinese-made goods and independent producers are being driven to bankruptcy. Good. Mao's conclusion, he says here, Mao, he says, once we understand all these contradictions, we shall see it. We shall see in what a desperate situation, in what a chaotic state China finds herself. We, turning the page, shall also see that the high tide of revolution against the imperialists, the warlords, and the landlords is inevitable and will come very soon. All China is littered with dry faggots. It says that. I didn't make that up. It says the word faggot on there. So, he's talking about weeds, though, which will soon be aflame. The saying, a single spark can start a prairie fire, is an apt description of how the current situation will develop. We need only look at the strikes by the workers, the uprisings by the peasants, the mutinies of soldiers, and the strikes of students, which are developing, to see that it cannot be long before a spark kindles a prairie fire. Maybe them flyers that I've been talking about, maybe that could start a little kindling of fire if you distribute them in the white neighborhoods. Maybe the black neighborhoods, too. Something the blacks would maybe start talking trash about. Black people cannot help themselves. They will talk trash. And that'll just set it off even more. So, I hope we're working towards that. In his theory of guerrilla war, whether against domestic and foreign enemies, Mao distinguishes carefully the various phases of development of the campaign, laying particular emphasis on the first phase, which he calls the period of the strategic defensive. In the beginning, the first phase may last for many months. Territory is nothing. Attrition is everything. We don't want territory. We're not going to raise hell in the urban centers because we want to reclaim them. Eventually we will, years later, after years of struggle, or months of struggle. Who knows how long it would take? Territory is nothing. Attrition is everything. We need to cause the attrition of resources and manpower of our enemy. Who's our enemy? Damn near everybody. Schools, government, everybody. Okay, it says territory, nothing, attrition, everything. The enemy is permitted, even encouraged, to expand where he will. Gives him a false sense of security, maybe. The guerrillas give ground, conducting only harassing actions, circling around, fighting always in the enemy's rear areas, and presenting no continuous front for the foe to smash. Very interesting. And that is guerrilla warfare. Let's see how our buddy James Mowry is doing. James Mowry is the WASP. He is the WASP of the book called WASP by Eric Frank Russell, a book written in 1957. Very interesting reading this book because there's absolutely no reference to sex in it. I think that's great. And one thing you hear Frank Bauer rail against is pornography. The image of a naked white woman just posing gracefully is beautiful. That's not pornography. I'm talking about when you have a white girl shoving a dildo up her vagina you know, or some sex scene with a man. I don't want to see that. And I don't, and by no means do I come from a Christian perspective with that. I hate pornography. All these adult bookstores, I'd like to see all of them just wiped off the map. And every book and video burned. Because mostly it's white women that are doing this stuff, and it's white women who are getting these dollars thrown in their face to do these things. Why should they have a husband and have some children if they're going to make all kinds of money by whoring themselves out? I mean, I'm not a woman, and I guess I'm underestimating the lure of money and independence that this line of work can give. But war and death to pornography, and I mean that from the bottom of my black, wretched heart. I'm going to read a passage in this. You may not know what's going on, but Maori is being commissioned by this guy named Wolf. Think of your James Bond movies. And this guy Wolf gave a couple examples of people who did something as object lessons. And then it says here, Maori handed back the papers. What's all this to me? We'll take those reports in order as read, began Wolf. They prove something of which we've long been aware of, but which you may not have realized. Now let's take the first one. The Romanian did nothing, positively nothing, except stare at the sky and mumble. He's talking about the crowd here. Some Romanian guy staring at the crowd saying, look, look, it's coming, it's coming. And nobody, you know, a bunch of people gather around them, first 10, then 20, then 2,000, and they're like, I guess saw the same thing or whatever. Herd instinct, I guess that was the object lesson there. Yet he forced the government to start jumping around like fleas on a hot griddle. It shows that even given conditions, action and reaction can be ridiculously out of proportion. By doing insignificant things in suitable circumstances, one can obtain results monstrously in excess of effort. Like those flyers I told you guys about. I'm going to keep harping on that until I see the shit on the news. Oh, I said a curse word. Sorry about that, guys. Okay, however, Wolf went on. The problem becomes less formidable than it looks if we bear in mind that one man can shake a government. Two men temporarily pin down an army, 27,000 strong. Or one small wasp can slay four occupants, or can slay four comparative giants and destroy their huge machine into a shambles. He paused, watching Maori for effect, then continued, which means that by scrawling suitable words on a wall or by you guys distributing the flyer that I told you guys to put together, I can't do it, guys. I am not computer savvy enough to do stuff like that. And I know for a fact, I've read some of the stuff in the Aryan updates, and there's some real computer savvy guys on this network here. So I got 15 minutes left, which means that by scrawling words, suitable words on a wall, the right man in the right place at the right time might immobilize an entire armored division. That's pretty unorthodox form of warfare. This goes right along with guerrilla warfare that I'm reading here for you guys, which I'm reading because I want to infer that reading needs to be done on this subject. Will I entirely be on my own, or will other earthlings, they have another word there, but I don't even want to try and pronounce it, will other earthlings be operating on the same planet? Don't forget, this guy Wasp, he goes to another planet. And I guess Earth is at war with this other planet or their legion of planets. And he's made to look like them and everything else. And, you know, it's an intergalactic thing, not intercontinental. Will there be other Earthlings that are operating on the same planet? If there will be others, how shall I make contact? So as far as you're concerned, you will be the only Earthling for 100 million miles around, replied Wolf. You will have no contacts, so you won't be able to betray anyone to the secret police. Think about that, guys. Moving to another city, keeping your mouth shut, no tattoos, no neo-Nazi reading material. if anyone ever does come into your apartment, you're not going to have a picture of Hitler on your wall, or you're not going to have a book of George Lincoln. You've done enough reading of that sort. If you're new to this, then by all means read that stuff so you know what we're talking about. But if you've been in this thing for a few years, you know, you don't need to read another book about how bad the Jews are or how bad the American political spectrum is. You know what needs to be done. Stop reading books. Stop writing. Some of you have a gift of writing. Please, by all means, continue writing. June, please, continue writing. But we got enough of that out there, and that's June's gift, writing. Who knows what he does on his off time, but says here, says you will have no contacts, so you won't be able to betray anyone to the secret police. They have a different word for secret police there. I don't want to try and, you know, pronounce it Kaitempe or something like that. Nothing they can do will extract from you information that you don't possess. They may torture you, but your only answer will be, "Is I don't know." And reading this booklet on security, you got a thing in there about torture. Okay. All right. Purple face, pin back ears, Mashabi accent will be equally convincing, but his greatest protection will be the mental block in every Syrian, not Syrian as in like Syria, the country, Syrian as in the Syrian constellation, whatever. I guess there's a star called Sirius, or there's a planets there that Earth wants to invade or whatever. But his greatest protection will be the mental block in every Syrian's mind. They won't suspect that an Earthman was masquerading as a Syrian because the idea was too ridiculous to contemplate. How about a guy who lives in Ohio, relocates to Seattle? In Ohio, he's known for wearing Cleveland Browns jerseys and Cleveland Indians starter jerseys, and he's known, he has a set program, he's known for dressing a certain way and this and that. Moves to Seattle, wears clothes that are totally foreign to what people would suspect him of wearing. Maybe growing his hair out if he's been wearing short hair all his life. Maybe cutting his hair if he's been wearing long hair all his life. Just totally reinventing himself and then going to work as a WASP for the white race. WASP. White Anglo-Saxon predator. Okay, I mean, this can be done, but it takes a man with some serious nads to be able to pull this off. But primarily, he was seeking to estimate the climate of public opinion with particular reference to minority opinions. Okay, a guy can go to another area and stir up resentment towards a minority or stir up the minority against the surrounding majority. Chaos is our friend. You know, one time I went into a Mexican car shop to deliver auto parts and stuff. I guess I'll stop my reading right there. I'll pick it up later. And I'll end with this story. This was about the time when the Mexicans were doing all these immigration protests and whatnot. And these Mexicans don't know my racial views. I'm very friendly to them. I speak Spanish to them. I tell them how much I love Mexican women. Lie. I tell them how much I love Mexican food. Lie. And I really earned their trust over some months. I mean, you know, I go in there and they're eating their tortillas and their pollo with the chicken and all that stuff. And they invite me to sit down and eat with them. And I do. And when I had these immigration rallies, you know, and I was in this garage, I was telling them, why are you Mexicans so silent about being exploited by these companies? You guys work too hard for this. You know, you guys are so afraid of being deported that you guys, you know, are being treated like garbage. You're being treated like dogs. And one of the Mexicans said, why do you care? I said, I'm for the working man. I believe in all the workers of the world being united. And you Mexicans are betraying your race by staying silent and by, you know, not raising hell for more wages and for insurance and all this other stuff. You are betraying the Mexican race. That's what I said to them. And I can tell by looking at them, and it's, you know, it's not hard to impress upon blacks and Mexicans. Mestizos, not white Mexicans, are very sharp. But mestizos and blacks, I mean, they really are. Majority of them are very primitive-minded. I mean, you really... So what I did with that, I could see it in their face. They're like, you know what? And a lot of you have to think, what the hell are you doing, Frank Bauer? You should be telling them to get out of your country. No, I'm an engine of chaos. I want them out of this country, but I want them to raise hell first. I want them to raise hell with all these insurance companies that are, you know, advertising to get their business. I want them to raise hell with the car companies and the credit companies and everywhere. I want them to be a thorn in the side of the system that invited them in this country and basically paved the way for them to come into this country. That's what I did. That's what I do with a lot of Mexicans. I don't, you know, Mexicans I don't know, yeah, sure enough, I give them a stare down and call them a mojado, which means wetback. I call them a parásito, which means parasite. You know, if I don't know them, I'll do that. But if I know them, I earn their trust, and I act like I just love everything about Mexican culture and music. And then I plant these seeds in their head about revolution, about, you know, about the workers, the Mexican workers. You know, you gotta stand up and fight. You gotta raise hell. You gotta riot. And that's what I do. And I plant these seeds of dissension in their primitive brains. And someday, I haven't seen anything yet, but someday it's going to come to a head. But one good thing about that is that I've earned their trust. That I can easily approach them with a smile on my face, make it much easier to stab them in the back or slash their throat. Because they don't see me as an enemy. And when the shit hits the fan in this country, and all these alphabet soup law enforcement agencies are home protecting their own families because there's really no government to defend anymore. It's just dog-eat-dog, Mad Max, Nightmare USA. When it comes to that, then I guess it'll be time for me to extract my payment for all my hard work. WASP, white Anglo-Saxon predator. 14.
Well, there he goes. Scary guy, huh? Yeah! You're not going to get that on Stormfront or VNN, I don't think. You're going to get that on the Insurgent Radio Network. Thank you, boys, for getting your club dues in. Been coming in pretty good. Very good. Thank you. That's P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Make your envelopes to Tom Metzger or the Insurgent or the box holder. And if you want to make your check donations to cash, that's fine too. Money orders, you name it. You don't even have to put your name on a money order. And we do take offshore currency, too. So there you go. There you go. We've been getting a lot of good stuff coming in from the UK. Yeah, thank you, UK guys. We need to know what's going on over there. We got a very good YouTube video in that we were putting on our NAV about how we can all start pointing our cameras at the cops. You know, they got cameras on every corner, all over the place, watching everything we do. Let's take pictures of cops and agents and MI5 or whatever they are, FBI agents, Treasury agents, wherever we can find them. Let's put a camera in their puss and see how they like it. Yeah, you might find they treat you with a little bit more respect after they get the message you're not going to go away. I hear the boys, the anarchist boys, are raising some hell up there in Minneapolis. Main news not talking about it. Well, I support that. I support those little anarchists giving the system hell. They may not like us because we're white racists, but that's all right. As long as they're giving the system a bad time, that's okay. That's okay. And if I lived a little bit closer to Minneapolis, I'd be marching down there with them. Yeah. The only thing better would be if they could drag some of those political sons of bitches out of the hall and hang them from a lamppost. Boy, that'd be the day. Whoa, wow, man. We're going to close out with some country music, or some music anyhow.
My little man loves me.